This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland with Mark Stephen and Helen Needham.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. And this week, for some reasons cheerful, some reasons not so cheerful, we concentrated pretty heavily on birds. It is surprisingly cool this morning. I expected it to be warmer, but it's not. I've got the fire on, but just above us. Look, see all swifts.
Oh.
Can't hear them. They're not screaming. But they're up there and they must be eating something. Anyway, I'm Mark Stephen, standing here in the car park in Beechgrove in Aberdeen. Joining me this week in the early morning sunshine, a little ray of sunshine herself.
Well, I'm
Helen Needham.
I'm very pleased because the sun was just behind the corner of the building there, and now it has appeared just as we've come on the radio.
And what did I say?
Yes, you said that would happen, didn't you? Yeah. Okay, you're right.
It's science.
Well, what can you do? Get in touch with us. We love hearing from you. What are you up to today out and about in the Scottish countryside and beyond, anywhere in the world? Tell us. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can text 80295. Your standard network message rate applies. And you can call as well, 08085 92 95 00, and Quentin's here to take your calls.
Heaps more actually coming up this week. Recently I was down in the southwest in Whithorn. Loads going on down there, including the new Whithorn. Way more on that soon. And you were up Norney.
Yes, not this week, but a couple of weeks ago I was up there with the Travelling Folk team. Delighted to get back to the Orkney Folk Festival at the end of May. And whilst we were there, I managed to get out and about and do some recording for Out of Doors. So stay tuned for some Orkney swans and grasses as well.
Absolutely. Next week, we're very much looking forward to going down, sees the return of the Royal Highland Show. Now, it is the biggest agricultural event in Scotland. And as highlights of the calendar go, it's right up there, especially after an absence of 3 years due to COVID. Now, we'll be heading down next week, and somebody else is going along is John Sleed, Northern Editor of the Scottish Farmer. John's family farm is quite near me in Aberdeenshire, so yesterday I popped along just to get his thoughts ahead of next week, and I started off by asking him, what do you reckon the main topics of conversation are going to be at the show?
Well, a lot of farmers will be coming down to the show thinking the amount of money they're having to pay for things on their farm has been going up and up in the last 12 months. So they're very worried about, you know, the cost of fuel, the cost of equipment, the cost of staff. And they'll be sharing that with their fellow peers, kind of comparing notes to find out whether they're the only ones that are having to pay all these huge bills. Yeah. The flip side will be a lot of farmers have seen their prices go up, so there'll be a buoyancy among certain sectors. You'll see arable farmers will be seeing their prices have gone up a lot in the last year. Milk prices have gone up as well, and even the sheep price is quite strong. So there'll be a mix between anxiety over how much things are costing, but there'll also be a bit of optimism that the prices have gone up correspondingly.
Farmers have got this special rate for fuel on what's known as red diesel. It's dyed so that, you know, specifically it is for their use, pure and simple. How's that sitting at the moment?
Well, red diesel, for some people, has almost gone up three times over the last year, which is an increase that a lot of farmers are staring at and wondering. You know, the cost of running a tractor a week is going up by hundreds and hundreds of pounds. It's a real worry for farmers to work out how they're going to make ends meet with this ever-escalating cost.
I've had conversations with my neighbours recently about how much fertiliser are they putting? Are they putting fertiliser on things like that? Because a lot of people don't realise that artificial fertiliser is largely generated from oil or gas.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the short of it is that we wouldn't be able to feed 7 billion people across the world if it wasn't for artificial fertiliser. And the prices this spring, well, for instance, last year it was about what would it be, £300 a tonne, and this spring some guys were paying up to £1,000 a tonne for the commodity. Those sort of increases, I mean, it's very difficult for most businesses to be able to take into account the rise like that. So farmers were looking at alternative practices. Would they maybe have fewer animals in a field and look to maybe graze them a little bit more lighter? Or would they look at maybe changing the way they apply them so they only applied the absolute minimum in the right bits of the crop? But again, all of this takes time to work out and also probably more expensive equipment.
Yeah, the thing is, it's suck it and see time too, isn't it? Because we haven't been here before, or not for a long, long time. So essentially farmers are looking at it and thinking, OK, what do? Do I pay more to produce the same crop, or do I produce less crop?
Yeah, it's a gamble. I mean, there's a bit of a split in the farming industry, if I'm honest. We see people perhaps 60 plus who went through this in the late 70s into the 80s, they're starting to think that, oh, here we go again, where inflation was going up and things were a really difficult time. Whereas younger farmers really have never experienced anything like this before. We've never seen commodity prices rise at such a rapid rate. And we also, luckily, I've never seen some of our output prices rise at such a rapid rate. But it's a very challenging time because farmers have got to really go back to the basics, look at their book and think, right, how do we produce food on this farm? What's an absolutely necessary cost? And what do we think we could trim? Because every single invoice coming up that road is a lot more than it was last year.
How difficult is it to actually get bodies onto the farm, to get staff?
Staff is becoming increasingly difficult on farms for all sorts of reasons. We've got the work-life balance of farmers. You have a lot of staff who are expected to work 7 days a week and evening work, which modern times is becoming less and less popular. We also have Eastern Europe. They used to supply a lot of labour, particularly for the soft fruit sector. They are no longer able to come here. And then we have general wage escalation, or wages going up, and staff being tempted to move on to other businesses. Construction's attracting a lot of people coming back in. Oil and gas is picked up here in Aberdeenshire, so they're getting their heads turned and thinking, perhaps we'll go somewhere else.
But what's the general mood in Scottish farming at the moment? Is it positive? And they must be looking forward to going to the Royal Highland Show.
I think, first of all, the Highland Show is a chance to let their hair down, a chance to have a bit of fun, and a chance to meet up with their friends that they probably haven't seen for quite a while, thanks to COVID. But overall, I think there's a lot of anxiety, and the real fear is how much they're having to spend on these invoices coming in. The price of commodities going up enough to cost to cover the payments that they're having to make. I mean, it's a really difficult time that we haven't really come through before.
No, it'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to it myself, but you know, if we go to the machinery stands, which is usually in the sort of southeast side of the show field, etc., quite interested to talk to some of those guys and see if they're actually selling machinery, because again, money's tight, people are being careful.
Yeah, the machinery guys will be looking to see if they're going to have a good show or not, and they've had to swallow quite a lot of price rises as well. I mean, the price of metal's gone up, the price of production's gone up, and I mean, there's been a lot of halts in the manufacturing process due to COVID, so tractors haven't been able to be made quite as quickly or in the right place at the right time. And then we have the big challenge of Russia and Ukraine. They used to be able to buy an awful lot of equipment and even produce some equipment, and that war has caused a devastating impact to a lot of these businesses who have looked to be either, they had big presences over there, have they shut down? Has Claas pulled out, for instance? Are they keeping going? So there's a real headache. So I think part of it will be trying to get the business done if there's farmers there, but the other part will be letting their hair down and enjoying themselves.
Yeah. Just one last thing. Over the last 10 years, I've noticed that, you know, certainly climate change, you know, carbon production, carbon savings, etc., all that's been growing in importance in Scottish farming. I wonder, with everything else that's going on at the moment, whether that will actually slide back down the agenda.
Well, this is something that I think has really changed in the last few months. We see, for the first time, the government talking much more about food security. The UK government this week released their food strategy. They talked very much of home production, domestic production of food. Climate change hasn't gone away. Climate change isn't going to go away. But I think the general feeling is we need to make every single hectare work harder, whether that's sequestering carbon, whether that's for biodiversity, whether that's producing food. We can't afford to have any acres in the country that are left to be unproductive or not trying to achieve one of the difficult targets. I mean, last week we had the French minister changed from being the agri-food minister to the agri-food and food sovereignty minister. Wow. It's become so important that in his very title, in the very essence of the people who are in charge of food production, is sovereignty and ability to feed your own country. It's front and centre.
John Slee there, Northern Editor of the Scottish Farmer. And we'll be down at the Royal Highland Show next week, as I said. It won't be live on the Saturday, but we'll be bringing lots of highlights as the show returns, all singing, all dancing for the first time since 2019.
Yeah, well, it will be very interesting to gauge what people are saying, actually, because it's a very sort of mixed time, isn't it? Mm-hmm. All sorts of pressures.
I'll tell you, I mean, just fuel costs, I mean, particularly just the... I came in this morning, went past a filling station, the Bridge of Dawn. Diesel, £2.59.
Yeah.
Per litre. I don't know what that works out at the gallon. I will work it out per gallon, but I reckon it's well over £8. Mm. Must be nearly £9, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's think about anything more cheerful than that,
than
that topic. The remnants of our human past exist all over Scotland, and some are more noticeable and celebrated than others.
Cal Flynn is an author based in Orkney. Her book, Islands of Abandonment, focuses in on places around the world which have been abandoned and reclaimed by nature.
A really good example of this are the West Lothian Bings, as she explained to Helen when they met recently up in Stromness.
I'd never really thought about them. So there's these huge sort of rose gold land masses, and they are the remnants of the mining industry of the 19th century. They would have been this gravelly stuff called shale. It was superheated to produce a kind of paraffin-type oil. And then the leftover, the spent shale, was just piled up in these enormous bings, as they're described, these spoil heaps. And what's happened over time is that they've become recolonised by lots of different types of plants through this amazing process called sort of seed rain, or also seeds dropped by the droppings of birds. And you get these very weird feral ecosystems, which are incredibly biodiverse and therefore quite valuable in their own way. And so these sites that were the epitome of being unvaluable have now become incredibly interesting from a scientific perspective, as well as representing some of the industrial heritage of the area.
Because they're not always perceived in a very positive way from the human perspective, are they?
I think originally not. I suppose because they were enormous waste heaps, and they were a little bit dangerous too, so sometimes they might reignite. I know that there were at least a small number of cases where children were burnt, and so that no longer happens. It took quite a long time for them to settle down, and I think they kind of became the sort of wallpaper to people's lives. You know, you stop paying attention to them, they're just there, they're kind of like big hills. But some of them are amazing, so like the Five Sisters, which is set up in a kind of scallop shape. It's really a monumental landmark. You know, it's an incredible thing to go and walk up, and it's quite easy to access most of these bings. Although you have to be careful, there are a few sort of mine shafts and things around, so check your maps.
You write in great detail about an island not so far from here as well.
Absolutely. So I went to visit Swona, which is between the Orkney Islands, where I live now, and the north coast of Scotland. It's in the Pentland Firth. There's actually two abandoned islands there, one called Swona, the smaller one, which I visited, and Stroma, which is larger, but is still being farmed with sheep. I was interested in Swona particularly because there is a small herd of feral cattle living on the island. I guess I was interested in the sort of philosophical question that they seem to pose, which is, when do these feral animals start being wild again? You know, is it through their wild behaviour, in which case they are already behaving wild now, or they act a lot more like wild horses or wild deer? They don't really enjoy the company of humans and can be a little bit aggressive if you get between them and their calves. Or is it something more genetic? Is it something that's inherent to the animal itself, in which case maybe they can never be wild again? And so I was interested in that, but also the experience of being in, I suppose, extreme isolation on these islands. I was dropped off by a local boatman and left for 24 hours and picked up again the next day. And in that short space of time, while I was really quite safe, or I felt myself rationally to be safe, I did also feel that it did some very strange things to my mind of being alone and being in the sort of remnants of other people's lives. It was a very sort of frightening time for me. It was a bit of a gothic horror.
Yeah, I got that sense when I was reading it. I could feel my heartbeat racing, actually. I was just imagining, you know, when you were sleeping. Well, the guy, Hamish, had advised you to sleep in the house and not sleep outside the house because of the cattle, basically. Mm. But, you know, hearing the noises when you're in the house and so on, gosh, I can't imagine you got very much sleep.
No, I don't think so. And it was a solstice, so it was pretty bright, you know, outside. And so I just remember that night as being this sort of long, never-ending limbo land of being on edge, and very quickly I felt that I wasn't able to eat. I couldn't relax. All of these kind of things that I associate with, maybe with watching a sort of horror movie or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Your mind must be going in all sorts of places. But the interesting thing there about the cattle was because they've, as you said, they've just been left, and then so have the corpses as well, that you actually had such a physical reaction to one of the cadavers.
Yeah, that's right, because, you know, of course they're not being cleaned up afterwards as they might on a normal farm, so you do stumble upon the corpse of a cow here or there, and there's quite a lot of them, and they are quite powerful and smelling, you know, and that, I think, caught me off guard, and it was probably one of the things that contributed towards my sort of psychological reaction to being on the island.
Plus, of course, the bird, because the bird is their home too, isn't it? So when you're wandering about, they're thinking, who the hell's this in my territory?
Yeah, that's right. I think I was a little bit naive because I wanted to go out during the seabird breeding season, because that's when you see all of these amazing species. But of course, that's the season when they are least happy to see you. And so I accidentally blundered into an Arctic tern colony and was dive bombed and scratched by them. And then I blundered into an area where bonksies or great skuas were living, and they can be pretty aggressive. They sort of spit and vomit in your direction, that kind of thing. And sort of was like toppling from section to section. And I keep seeing to move into a new country, a new region of different bird territory, which I would upset afresh, and so I ended up taking shelter with the puffins and sitting with the puffins quietly for a while.
Yeah, the puffins are a bit more chilled, aren't they? But I suppose it is one of these places that is a rare example of somewhere that humans are not the dominant species.
I think so. I definitely had that sense of this not being my place, and that helped me feel sort of out of place and uncomfortable, and really the birds were giving much more than they got. You know, it was my mere presence was enough to set up almost what felt like a kind of civil war against my presence on the island, and the oyster catchers were following me around and shrieking, and it was just like, I don't know, being very close to like a car alarm. You know, it was like constant in my head the whole time, and that added to my sense of anxiety.
And what did you take from that then, in terms of the themes of the book?
I think what I took from that was this idea that once you allow a place to rewild, whatever that means to you, you can't expect it then to be a human-friendly place. And so these animals were used to having the island to themselves, and my presence was therefore entirely a negative from their point of view. And although I had sort of imagined it might be a nice thing for me to watch, and it was if I stayed very still and hidden, you know, they weren't pleased to see me.
Gav Flynn, the author of Islands of Abandonment, which is in the latest edition of Scotland Outdoors on BBC Sounds. There's a lot of stuff, you know. I really like the idea of living in an island, you know, or staying in an island overnight and what have you, but it must have been kind of spooky.
Yeah, I think so. And also the remnants of previous human inhabitation as well. Mm-hmm. You know, when you come across an abandoned house, or I always find myself kind of slightly reticent about going. I know other people who really love raking about in places like that. I bet you're one of them.
I am. As a matter of fact, you know, and I remember way back when I was a teenager, we moved into, our house was literally in the outskirts of Inverurie at the time, and now there is about a mile of housing, you know, to the other side of us towards the west. But there was a farm across the way which was abandoned. It was going to be knocked down and they were going to build other houses on that. But I found the midden. I found the midden, and I spent a summer at the age of, 13, 14, something like that, digging through the midden. Boy, the stuff that I found in that. I mean, it was just extraordinary. Old Victorian pencil sharpeners. There was a fleam that I picked up.
What's a fleam?
A fleam is, basically, it was a tortoise shell handle, and there were three blades in it, and it's almost like an arrowhead, but the arrowhead points not in the line of the shaft, but at 90 degrees. And it was for bleeding animals.
Oh, goodness.
You know, you basically horses or cattle or things like that, what have you, and there was a little wooden mallet that you used with a fleam just to open up a wound and, you know, theoretically bleed out the bad humours. I mean, nobody's done it in donkey's years, in donkey's years. But I found one of these things, and it had a tiny little ivory, almost like a separator, for like picking out your teeth or something like that, but one of those just for slightly opening the wounds and letting it bleed properly.
Goodness me.
Fascinating the stuff you find.
Yeah, well, we've had some correspondence. Carolyn Fowlis emailed in to say, I listened to Helen and Kyle discuss Kyle's book while lying in the sun in Mallorca. It made me long for the wonderful, cool climate at home in Stirlingshire. However, I'm not complaining. Another one here from Rachel. I'm listening to you from sunny Jersey. I shall be out walking the lanes
to annoy me now.
Later on, hoping to see some butterflies.
Ah, I haven't seen many butterflies this year. I'll tell you the other thing that worries me, that, you know, they've just taken the silage with us. I'm not hearing the curlews anymore.
Oh, goodness me. There'll be more on that soon, actually, with Patrick Laurie in next week. And another one here from Sam. Thank you for the podcast. I listen on the 5 a.m. 124 Lothian bus on a Tuesday morning as I commute Aberlady to work in Edinburgh for my one day a week. It makes my journey much more enjoyable.
Oh, I'm delighted here. And thank you so much for all your comments. You can always contact us at outofdoorsbbc.co.uk. Right, time now to introduce another of the stories you've chosen to pass down to the next generation of your families. This contribution to 100 Years of Scottish Stories is a family tale about the Rolls-Royce workers in Hillingdon.
100 Years of Scottish Stories on BBC Radio Scotland.
My name is Karen and I'm going to tell you the story of how my grandfather stole a bus from Rolls-Royce. My papa lived in Pollock during the Second World War and he volunteered in the Home Guard. That's the Dad's Army for those who are too young to know. He learned lots of new skills to keep Glasgow safe and moving when the younger men were away to war. After the war, he began to work in Rolls-Royce in Hillingdon. After a hard day's work, he came out to find that there were no buses available to take the hard-working men back to Pollock. So after a fair bit of heated discussions, my papa decided to jump into a bus and take all the men with him. He'd learned how to drive a bus as part of the Dad's Army. So he jumped into the bus and instructed all the Pollock boys to jump in, and off they went to sunny Pollock. In my mind, it's a bit like Cliff Richard's summer holiday. So not long after that, Papa was arrested, and my dad recalls how his classmates kept telling him how his dad was going to go to jail. Fortunately, he didn't go to jail, and I guess for one day, my Papa was the hero in Pollock.
100 years of Scottish stories. Share your story. Head to bbc.co.uk/radioscotland.
Karen with a story there about a grandfather on a bus. And if you've got a family story to share, you can get in touch via the BBC Radio Scotland website. We would like to hear from you.
You can get in touch to tell us here what you're up to this weekend. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 82295, your standard network message rate applies. You can call Quentin on 0808 592 9500. And actually, we've been thinking about this stories business a bit.
Have you now? You've been thinking again.
Yeah, I've been thinking
again. We've spoken to you about that.
Yeah, I know, don't try too hard. But we're actually wondering if people would like to get in touch and tell us their stories that are related to place and landscape.
Uh-huh.
Because we're thinking about maybe doing a story special at some point in the next few months for Out of Doors.
Okay, right. Fine.
So
okay.
Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Any stories relating to place, stories about the outdoors, memories and so on.
Memories. Whittorn is a very pretty wee town in the southwest of Scotland, and it's somewhere there's a lot going on. The Whittorn Trust was formed in 1986 to try and interpret the area's archaeology and history, which is rich and varied, and since then it's carried out many projects and involves the local community in heaps of different ways, as I found out from Julia Muir Watt, Chief Executive of the Trust.
This is a prehistoric logboat based on Bronze Age and Iron Age models that are found locally, and the trainees on our traditional skills course made it just using axes and adzes.
This is a very, very sophisticated transom-ended logboat. I've heard of them, but I've never actually seen one built.
They do exist. You can find evidence of transoms and other carpentry in prehistoric boats, so it's not inauthentic.
You know, the tail end, basically, it's almost like they've got a bulkhead at the back which pulls out. You pack it with moss, make it watertight, etc. You know, and you could either, if it was big enough, drive sheep or something on there. It was just an easier way of getting on and off the boat.
Sure. Yes, I mean, this was carved out of a giant redwood, which is not authentic, but we had to go with trees that were dying or potentially windfall rather than cut down a wonderful oak of that size. So.
Fair enough, hence the name Ruhr.
Yeah, red. Exactly.
Okay.
So this is our reconstruction Iron Age roundhouse, dating to the Middle Iron Age. We based it on a real archaeological find about 5 miles away, and it belongs to the showiest and biggest phase of roundhouse building.
Why did the Trust decide to do this?
We'd been very much involved with the Black Lock of Merton dig. As I say, it was in the locality. But we also knew that on this very site, just about where we're walking, there was evidence of two roundhouses, which are a mysterious feature of our earliest phase of activity at Whitthorn.
This is a magnificent building. Absolutely stonking. So essentially it's got a thatch roof, which is conical. But it's a really lovely organic curve at the front, isn't it?
Yes, we're very pleased with the thatcher who did it, and he trained up some volunteer and amateur thatchers with him. So it is quite a feat that they've managed.
And all those, I mean, you know, the planking that's around the outside looks seriously heavy duty. I mean, inches and inches thick. Is yes. that all hand-sawn?
It is hand-sawn, and it replicates what they found at the archaeological dig. Because the archaeological dig was in a bog, effectively, all the timber was wonderfully preserved. So instead of, as on many roundhouse digs, you simply found a trace of colour or a stain, they were actually digging out massive pieces of oak, which took a couple of men to manoeuvre. So it is definitely based on the real thing.
Can we get into it?
Of course.
It is a bit like a wizard's hat, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Oh, yes. Now, if you walk in here, you can hear the difference. It's really quite dead sound. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, keep going, 8 huge trunks holding up the absolute apex of the roof. And then it's all out to a bigger circle, and you would have had animals out here and the fire in the centre. It smells right too.
Yes, we do use the fire. There's actually, to blind the archaeology beneath, there's a protective layer of modern materials, so we're not actually altering the geophysics underneath. But it is an authentic feature. This is exactly what we found in the archaeology. So there was a metre square fireplace in the middle, and they probably used it for cooking, but also for some sort of semi-industrial processes like dyeing or maybe some smelting, because we did find a crucible as well.
Just come back outside this reconstruction, and the more I see of it, the better it gets. The door is possibly 5 or 6 inches thick, just made of solid bits of timber, presumably sawn on that saw rack over there. So you've got somebody up top and somebody down below pulling and shoving the saw.
That's a pit saw, yes. Yeah. And then we've been... No, we can't go do anything below ground here because of the archaeology, but...
Of course.
Yeah. We are showing the trainees that we have on our traditional woodworking course how medieval techniques worked. So that's very hard work, and you don't want to be the person below.
Why does the Trust exist? What's the purpose of it?
The Trust came into being with the first archaeological dig in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And it was designed to benefit the local community and to publicise the story of Whitthorn. So that's what we still do, and that's a long time ago.
How does this tie in, or does it tie in, to the Whitthorn Way?
So this is, obviously, we're the destination point of the Whitthorn Way, and it's important that we have venues where we can welcome people. Mm-hmm. I hope that in the future we will be looking at other reconstructions where we might look at the Northumbrian Church, for instance, which is a wooden timber stave church, and that's one of the reasons why we've got a lot of young trainees learning traditional carpentry and woodworking, that we can actually deal with local unemployment issues for young people at the same time as sticking to our mission to interpret Whitthorn's past.
Julian, you're Watt of the Whitthorn Trust there, and we'll hear more from her later in the programme as we talk about the Whitthorn Way.
And remember, get in touch with us. Let us know what you're up to, wherever you are in the world, which is exactly what people have been doing. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, your standard network message rate applies, and you can call as well. Quentin's waiting, poised to answer the telephone. 0808 595 9295 00. So these emails, Andy, Petra, Joe and Trina in Sicily, sailing from Marsala to Sardinia this morning, so we'll not be able to pick up the live broadcast, and they've got an emoji sad face. We'll catch up with
the
podcast. Thanks for such a brilliant show. And Alistair, usually in Elgin, good morning Helen and Mark from deepest Normandy, start of a camping trip, and I can confirm that the French Dawn chorus is loud through a millimetre of nylon. 35 degrees Celsius yesterday and much the same forecast for today. Should return to normal from Monday. I know it's a hard life, but someone has to do it. Good news is that you start here at the civilised time of 7:30. Thank you in anticipation of another excellent programme.
Oh, happy to oblige while you sit there underneath your nylon and listen to the birdsong. Marsala. Is Marsala not a type of drink?
Yes, I think I've used it once.
It's like a sort of sherry, it's like a sweet wine or something.
That kind of thing, yeah.
Okay, again, people tune into this programme for the knowledge that we nearly have.
Yeah.
Very nearly have.
Conjecturing.
Well, there's a lot of conjecturing goes on in this show, I'm telling you. Right, this is a bit less cheerful, unfortunately, than being abroad. We've probably all seen the coverage of the dead seabirds being washed up on Scotland's coastline over the past couple of weeks. I mean, thousands of gannets and skua and guillemots found from Shetland to the Western Isles and all down the east coast. The cause appears to be avian influenza, so-called bird flu. Now, this is not new. We've had bird flu in the past. So I asked Kirsty Nutt of RSPB Scotland, why is this different? Why is it so bad this time?
Previously, we would have seen big outbreaks in sort of domesticated poultry operations. You know, really starting, I guess, last autumn with geese on the Solway and continuing, sadly, into seabirds this year. We're seeing massive numbers of fatalities in wild bird populations.
How, I mean, if you were standing on the coast here, you know, and, the, you know, there's a gannet in front of you, who may or may not be poorly, how would it manifest itself?
So generally you see it in the fact the birds are not sort of doing normal behaviour, they're not moving away from you. So there's horrific images of gannets sort of sat unable to fly on the sea, and you also see quite a lot of head shaking from birds that appear to be infected. But mostly, yeah, it's just they look really, really unwell and really suffering.
I've seen reports from Shetland, for example, that are suggesting that thousands of gannets up there have died.
Yeah, gannets and bonksies, so great skuas, they appear to be the species that are most affected by this. And we are starting to hear some really, really quite disturbing numbers. So catching up with colleagues yesterday, initial estimates are from some of these great skua places where they're monitored every year, we might be looking at 60, 85% death of adult birds. And that is, you know, 6 to 8 in every 10 adults dying. And that's pretty much in a single year. Usually when we're talking about declines of 60%, we're talking about it over decades, or, you know, since the 80s, since the 70s. And it's a growing picture as more and more data comes in, as more and more people are counting. But, you know, this is something that we need to be really worried about, because it could be catastrophic for some of our seabirds, which are already facing so many pressures.
If you go somewhere like the Bass Rock, you know, there's what, 150,000 gannets on that, and they are literally living cheek by jowl, or even up to troop head, where they're kind of living on top of one another. It's avian influenza. It's a contagion. Touch. That's how it works. There's no way stopping it, really.
Yeah, there's touch, you know, droppings, feces, saliva, potentially scavenging on other dead birds that have had it. So, yeah, that's why it's so terrifying that it's in our seabirds, because they're so tightly packed, some of these seabirds in these breeding colonies, that you assume it's going to rip through. And while we're still learning a lot about, you know, the disease in general, and there isn't, you know, a magic cure or anything like that, there is action that we can take. So particularly Scottish Government, there's sort of two areas of action that we really can take.
Which is what?
So the first of those things is work we've already started on. So we're in a meeting this week convened by Scottish Government to look at a response plan. So we want that to include things like coordinated testing, coordinated monitoring, to look at biosecurity options that might be needed to limit the spread of this, really linking up the response between domestic outbreaks and wild bird outbreaks, and also looking at limiting disturbance of these species to limit the impact it's having. So that's things, I guess, in summer, like us all doing our part not to disturb nesting birds, keeping dogs on leads so that they're not finding sort of infected carcasses on the beach or, you know, disturbing birds that are sick with this. But it's also things like what we asked for last autumn, which was a temporary halt to hunting so that gunshots are not frightening potentially infected birds up where they might potentially move the virus around into other birds and things like that. And then the second area of action, which is equally urgent and equally as important, is to take action on some of the longer term threats that our seabirds have been facing that we've known about for years, but to really make sure that we take an opportunity to do targeted and effective interventions to help them. And really just taking action on a lot of the areas that we've known they're, you know, suffering from and threatened by for years, and where action has perhaps been a little bit sort of slow or ineffective. And I think this year is a great opportunity to do some of that. We've got Scottish Government writing a Scottish seabird strategy, and we absolutely need that to be as ambitious as it can be to help these birds.
What about on an individual basis? You mentioned keeping your dogs on leads, etc., and, you know, not walking through nesting areas, you know, that kind of thing. If you find something on the beach which is either dying or dead, presumably you just avoid it, or do you pick it up, bin it, back, and whatever?
So while public health agencies are saying there's really, really, really low risk of this, you know, for humans, the best advice we can give, and it's heartbreaking if you come across, you know, a bird that is dying but not dead yet, but it's just leave it alone. So leave it alone. If you're in areas where you know there's avian influenza, maybe try not to then be going to areas where you don't think it is, because we're not sure yet about how well it's transferred on footwear.
I wouldn't know.
I think if you're seeing mass mortality of birds in an area, at the moment that's unlikely to be anything else. So if you're walking along a beach, which sadly some people are coming across, 10, 12, 14 dead gannets on the beach, that's not a normal level of dead birds to be seeing when you're out and about. So it is, you know, keeping children and dogs away from them, don't pick them up, trying not to spread stuff, but also reporting them to the DEFRA helpline. And I think the other thing that people can do as individuals is pay attention to what's going on. It's so easy when your news or your social feeds are filled with these horrible pictures and this horrifying situation to just think, I'm just not going to look at it. And I think we kind of owe it to the birds to pay attention to what they're showing us is happening and to feel whatever we need to feel off the back of that, be that anxious, be that despair at sometimes, you know, hopelessness, be that anger, sadness, if you need to cry, and then to sort of think, okay, what can I do? Is there anything I can do as an individual? And if it makes you feel as sad and angry as I feel quite frequently at the moment, I think it's, you know, maybe thinking about writing to your MSP and explaining how this makes you feel and that you really want action to be taken. So why, you know, there's not a magic cure. There isn't something that we can all do immediately to help some of these birds. I think there is longer term stuff we can do both individually and at government level to make their lives easier and change the situation and to sort of turn things around, really.
I can't remember a time when seabirds particularly weren't in trouble around the Scottish coasts. But this is different. I mean, this, you know, I can feel you are genuinely worried by this, genuinely upset by this.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, the numbers that are coming in and the indications that we're getting isn't like anything we've faced before. So last autumn, we lost somewhere near 38% of the sort of Svalbard breeding population of barnacle geese on the Solway, more than 16,000 individual birds. And that was a lot. And then this year, we might end up seeing figures greater than that. And then bad news just keeps coming. We're quite early in the breeding season, particularly for species like gannets, who, you know, can be breeding all the way into, you know, sort of September, October time. And we don't know how bad this is going to get. And this is kind of just another thing on top of all the other stuff they were already dealing with. So climate change induced food shortages, climate change induced winter storm frequency increasing, which is like having massive adult mortality. And whereas geese have a lot of eggs each year, seabirds don't do that. They're long-lived birds. They take a long time to reach breeding maturity, and they tend to have maybe one or two chicks a year. So this could have massive long-term population consequences for species who are already some of our most threatened. What we need to be doing is taking this and all the other signs that we're getting from nature around the globe that it's in trouble, taking it really seriously and thinking, what are we doing to this planet and the other species that we share this planet with, and what should we be doing? And I think this really needs to be a wake-up call for real action, you know, not just the words, real action to change this.
Kirsty Nutt of RSPB Scotland there, and there's a link to the RSPB avian flu webpage where you can find details on how to report suspected cases.
I feel very moved by that.
Yeah, it really affected her, you know, and it's something that I hadn't thought about, you know. I remember talking to an ecologist some time ago who said, you know, says, occasionally I look across a landscape and everybody thinks, oh, isn't that lovely? Isn't it? It's nature, what have you. He says, and I'm seeing all the problems. And the people in the RSPB are in exactly the same situation, you know, that they are informed. They're worried about it on a level that most of us are not. So it's serious stuff. And as we mentioned, Royal Highland Show is back in full swing next week. And another event that's glad to have come out the other side of the COVID pandemic is the Scottish Traditional Boat Festival, which is held in Port Sawin. It's happening this very weekend. David Urquhart's the chair of the festival, and he joins us now. Good morning, David. How are you?
Morning.
Listen, I know there's heaps of arty-farty, crafty stuff and music and things like that going on, but tell me about the boats. What have you got in this year?
We've got the Isabella Fortunas here down from Wick. That is one of the main ones. We've got loads of ones. Boats from Billy Mill are here as well, in the Comet, a 1960s fishing boat.
So, David, what, take us right back to the start. How did the festival come about? When did it first launch, and what was the idea behind it?
It first launched would be in the 13th year of the Old Harbour, which was 29 years ago. That was a vision set up, and the Scottish Traditional Boat Festival was the spawn from there.
What I always loved about it is it's just, there's a real sort of homely feel about it. You know, you get in, the envy enjoys traditional boat building or wooden boats or little boats or things like that. There's a fascinating range of stuff there.
There's a lot of clinker-built boats and everything here just now. And there's one boat in the boat shed just now being repaired, showing how they repair the clinker side and they repair parts of the boat as well, so people can actually see that happening just now.
How did you get involved in it in the first place? I mean, what's your passion about it?
My passion is it's for the North East and for Port Soy. I'm a joiner in to trade, so boats is not my heavy forte, but I just believe it is very, very good for the local economy, and it brings a buzz to Port Soy.
And Port Soy itself is such a beautiful setting. Can you tell us a bit about is it a town or a village, David?
It is, well, it's classed as a village, I would say, because we're part of the village, the six villages. But because we've got the Tercentenary Harbour here, the 300-year-old harbour, not a lot of places have that. And okay, it's tidal. Then we've got the newer harbour further around where there's boats in as well. A lot of geology here as well. Aberdeen University comes up to see all those different things up here.
Well, the thing is, you've got, I mean, it's a stone-built harbour. The colours in it are absolutely fantastic. So the boats look, I mean, if you were to create a backdrop to put these little traditional boats up against it, you couldn't come up with anything better. You know, and you've got all the sort of big buildings, the old Georgian buildings in there too. You say it's a village, but this was, once upon a time, there was a lot of money passed through Port Soy.
Oh, it was a very, very thriving port, with the coal industry and the engine building house, because they used to build and they maintain engines up at the engine house at the station yard. Mm-hmm. And the railway line came all the way down to harbour. Mm-hmm. From a way back.
And it's not just the boats, there's all sorts going on. You had folk rock group Scary Vore playing last night. How did that go?
Oh, it was a sellout concert, and they went down a storm. It was a really great night and just set the tone for the weekend.
See, I think with my stomach a lot of the time, David. I don't know if you're any different. But the ice cream in Port Soy is always very good. And the chipper up at the top of the road, they actually do smoked haddock and a cheese sauce and a little pot with chips. Oh, it's fine.
Oh, yes, we're very, very lucky here because we've got nice local fresh products. It's always good. If you be the ice cream shop here, he's got with five different venues selling it today, so you're going to miss out on that one.
Well, that's a relief. There's also lots of other music and crafts and arts and crafts and so on. Tell us a bit about the other things happening at the festival.
Well, we've got two lots of art and craft tents here as well, and there's a variety of different things in it. All traditional made things and stuff like that. A lot of like the well hung and tender boys are here for the burgers and the steaks, real steaks. And then we've got the traditional food fair, which I think is with 30 different events happening around in there, from whiskey to gin to homemade bread. And this is from all over Scotland. There's folk here from Skye today as well, showing off their produce and selling their produce as well.
I understand that there is a programme on the televisual device called Peaky Blinders, and you've got a connection to that and all.
Well, we was lucky to host the Peaky Blinders filming here this last year, and we've been very lucky, and we have actually taken two of the original cars from the Peaky Blinders set that you saw Shelby sitting in, so you can come here this weekend and get a Shelby selfie. And they are sitting in the exact same spot as what you saw on the filming. So we've actually got a Peaky Corner this year.
So you've missed a trick there. You should have got somebody to do, you know, a barber to do the haircuts as well.
That can be arranged.
I bet you it could as well. David, listen, thanks very much for joining us today. That was kind of you.
No, thank you very much for giving the chance.
No, okay. No bother at all. I hope the weather stays good for you.
Well, it's glorious sunshine here just now, and all the people are busy setting up all their stands.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Good stuff. David Urquhart there, and there's a link to the festival website from ours if you fancy heading along to Portsoy this weekend.
It's exactly what I'm going to be doing.
You going up to Portsoy?
I am going up to Portsoy after this programme. Looking forward to it. I always enjoy the Portsoy Boat Festival.
Yeah, it's excellent.
It's just, and the thing is, it's just that whole atmosphere down at the harbour where you've got all the boats, which are just wonderful to look at. But the music as well, and people dressed up, and it just feels like you enter a different world for the day.
Yeah. No, I've always enjoyed my time there. What's your knowledge of grasses like?
Pretty minimal. I'm thinking
Yorkshire fog.
Timothy hay.
Timothy for hay.
But I wouldn't really know that much about grasses. What about you?
No, I'm not brilliant on it. My wife's actually, because of the horse connection, my wife's actually pretty good at this. My late father-in-law was very good at it. You know, he when he was at agricultural college, he'd been asked to put together a collection of grasses. So he did the sensible thing and he bought one from the year before. Somebody had actually put all the connecting, put labels underneath, and he just changed the labels.
Right.
That was Bob all over, I'm telling you.
Well, recently I did actually increase my knowledge of grasses because I was introduced to this completely fascinating world of grasses by the photographer Rebecca Marr. She's been working on a collaborative project with the poet Valerie Gillis called When the Grass Dances. Rebecca's based in Orkney, and she took me to a very special place close to the Ring of Brodgar in search of the rare holy grass. But before we get to that, here's a snippet of Valerie's poem, Sweet Vernal Grass.
The hill pasture is a pleasant place when sweet vernal grass is blowing. Its flavour always good to taste while the summer hayfield's growing.
Back in 2007 when I moved up here, Val came to visit me and we went to the Broch Adairness and we saw this really lush green grass, and when we look back on it now we realise that was the point at which we decided that one day we would do something about the grasses, because we just saw it as grass. We didn't recognise it as individual grasses, as individual species that all have their own properties and their own structures. And that's what's been amazing, is just delving into this world and watching it open out.
Well, shall we delve in then? There's a lot of vegetation here.
Yep.
And I can see lots of primroses, which is really nice.
Yeah. This grass is quite a rare grass, and it's not so easy to find. In fact, I've been looking for this grass for quite some time and not found it, and came here with John Crossley. He's the plant recorder for Orkney, and he showed me where it was, and it was where I'd been looking. I just didn't know what I was looking at.
Uh-huh.
Because you could just so easily pass over this grass. Here it is here.
Oh, there we go.
So right. This just looks like... Oh. You wouldn't really know what this grass was, but if I pick some here and I'll get you to do it two-hand, if you crush it and then smell it.
Oh, my goodness.
Got that smell? That smell is caused by coumarin. And it's also in sweet vernal grass, which is related to this grass.
Right.
Filled with essential oil of coumarin, flushed, its scent strongest when cut or crushed.
It's like a supercharged smell of when you get cut grass. It's on steroids, the smell here. It's amazing. It actually becomes stronger when the grass dries out. And it was used as a strewing herb in churches, in medieval churches, and that's one of the thoughts people have about why this grass is here.
Holy grass is sweet grass on chapel floors strewn wide.
It's hardly in any places in Scotland. It's in Benbecula, and it's here in Orkney, and it's in Dumfries and Galloway, John said as well. But in Orkney, it's in quite a few sites. It's John that found this grass here, at this site where we are. This very special site, you know, between Harry Loch and the Ring of Brodgar.
Because actually, as we came along here, you pointed out the fact that we're right between salt water and fresh water here.
Yeah, it's quite a special place, kind of liminal zone, isn't it?
Sweet grass is holy grass, running streams fructified. Braids of gold and green their own scent will keep, hung above beds serene to bring a blessed sleep.
This idea of this being a strewing herb, it would be put on the floors and dry out, so the smell would come up as you walked over the grasses. And I did dry some last year, and the smell really lingered. And it's sort of addictive. I find myself going past it and just having a little sniff of it.
I wonder if it has any effect on our well-being as well.
Well, it is a very special grass in Indigenous culture, and for First Nation people, this is one of the sacred herbs. So there's four sacred herbs, and this is known as sweet grass in First Nation culture. I don't know if you've come across this amazing book called Braiding Sweet Grass by Robin.
I've heard of it. It's on my list of things to read.
Oh, it's a great read. She talks a lot about this grass and the importance of this grass and what it can teach you. And that's something that Val the poet and I have been thinking about what grasses can teach us.
Well, I'm absolutely astonished because I wouldn't have known in a month of Sundays that this was a significant grass, because it's a very unassuming grass just in amongst vegetation here.
But the time that we're here, Helen, is actually it is in flower. Once you get your eye in, you can actually see that it's everywhere around here. But here's a flower, here. Isn't that pretty? Oh, look, if I hold my hand behind it.
You actually start to pick out colour within it, don't you?
Yeah, there's purples in there. And there's this beautiful white inflorescence coming off it. But yeah, this is called a panicle, the way it's spread out like that. There's all these great words in grasses. Val's great with all the grass words.
Hushel. The way wind crosses a field, sounding like grass waves passing through widening circles. Hushel.
We're now actually ducking down, and I feel like I'm sort of tuning into this landscape a bit more. Is that something that you found with this project, that you've started to look at the world differently?
It's a really fascinating world, the world of grasses. You know, they're really useful when we think about how resilient they are and how they are connected to humans and our animals. They can coexist with us, and they can cope with their grazing. They grow from the root, not the tip. So they've got this, like, there's this idea of resilience and recovery that you can pick up from the grasses. So we've been doing some workshops and thinking about these notions. We've been working with the Blyde, which is a mental health support organisation in Kirkwall, and they've been looking at the grasses and thinking about these ideas of recovery and resilience.
And actually sitting here in amongst the grasses next to Harry Loch and thinking about the fact that this particular grass has significance which goes back for centuries, really. There's a resilience within that, the fact that it's still here and thriving.
Yeah. This could all be one plant, so this could be like one community of one plant. And just hiding this beauty just like this, that you actually have to get your eye in to appreciate it. There's something really rewarding with working with the grasses when you do actually pay attention to them. You start to see things you hadn't seen before, and then you can't unsee them after that. So walks become really fascinating because you're now looking at grasses as well as everything else.
They're really connecting us with the soil beneath us, aren't they?
Absolutely, and connecting us to the fact that at one point we stopped and settled, and the grasses helped us do that. They're totally and utterly connected with us. I was in Bursey Bookshop and I found this really lovely Victorian book about the grasses by a botanist called Margaret Plews. And it's always lovely when you come across the woman botanist as well. And so this was 1874, this book. And I was reading the introduction. And in it, she talks about, she's urging people to get into the study of grasses because they're so fascinating. And she says in it that she thinks that if people take time, that paying attention to the grasses will result in admiration. And that admiration will ripen into friendship. And I think it's been like that.
Paschal. Grass is growing from the ground, moving everything within it. Life coursing through every being. Paschal.
Nice word, that. Paschal.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
And just in case anyone's wondering, that music is by Sekou Keita and Katrin Finch, because I know that people like to know
indeed
about the music.
What have you got in the bag, Helen? What have you got in the bag?
It's not a bag, it's a pouch.
A pouch?
It's a special
pouch.
It's
a lady pouch.
A lady pouch that has some holy grass that Rebecca gave me, and
okay.
Oh, it's got a bit caught up.
Caught up in your lady pouch. There you go.
Can you smell it?
Mmm. Yeah. That's nice, actually.
It is. It's good, isn't it? I have it next to my desk at home when I'm working.
It's a sort of vanilla scent to it. Yeah.
Yep.
That's really nice. It's like almost like sort of very, very fine raffia.
It is. But you wouldn't, honestly, you wouldn't notice it at all.
No.
Because it just looks like thin green grass. But it's actually this very special grass.
We were just talking about there. You can find examples of his work on the web. But Angus McPhee, who lived for many, many years up at Craigdonane in Inverness, and he would take grass and weave it into objects, things like boots or a jumper or a hat or a little horse, you know, whatever it was. Just, you know, an extraordinary. You know, somebody who had, you know, a desire to do so, to make something, to be artistic, and the only thing he had was grass.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was because he was from the US, wasn't it? So he'd grown up surrounded by grass. And there's an excellent book called The Silent Weaver by Roger Hutchison that describes Angus McPhee.
Is that the one? I've got a vague memory of this. Were they the ones that rode to war?
Yes,
the road to the Second World War on the little ponies.
Do you remember, we learned about this via Leonie Charlton.
That's the one.
When we were talking about
her
book, Marum, in fact. Some few comments here. Jim Harvey says, quite a few curlews and peewees on the road to Del Nabo from Tom and Towel. Great sight and sound. No modern farming going on there. And Ian Bruce says, morning, Helen and Mark. Listening in from a very sunny St. Fergus, sheltered from the wind. I love hearing both Cal Flynn and June Nelson talking on the midweek podcast. And actually, a few people have been in touch about the June Nelson podcast, saying how much they enjoyed it.
Oh, well, I really enjoyed speaking to her. I mean, just an extraordinary lady. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, I wish we had a means of actually saying, and this is what the inside of a house looks like. Because all the paintings they have, I think there were about maybe two or three pictures of family. The rest of it was basically just seabirds.
Yeah.
Anyway, you're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Helen Needham. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast we've just been talking about from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to it. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Patty DeVoe from Georgia, USA did. Her email is entitled, A Balm for Atlanta Traffic. Well, that's why we exist, Patty. Says, the traffic in Atlanta, Georgia, USA is horrible. Too many cars, too few streets, poor air quality, and just plain aggravating on a daily schedule. But I do not care anymore, because I listen to you in my car on the BBC podcast. So long traffic delays, no bother. I can just tune in to another Scotland Outdoors episode or enjoy revisiting a past one or two or three. Thanks so much for bringing the fresh air and humour of Scotland to our humid southern city.
P.S. I won lottery tickets to the 150th British Open. So we'll be at St Andrews on July the 12th and then off exploring Aberdeenshire, Macduff and Banff, where the owner of our historic home on St Simon's Island, Georgia, F.D.M. Strachan, was born in 1871, and then over to the west coast and the Isle of Arran, from where my murky ancestors departed in the 1830s. Along the way, we will enjoy exploring the hills and listening to the birds you have pointed out to us. Be there soon, Patty DeVoe. I'm just going to read another comment from Ian Bruce, who was emailing earlier from St Fergus. He then puts 10 minutes later, just listening to the section on the effects of the avian flu, just walking along the Scotstoun beach to Rattray Head, I've spotted a lot of bird carcasses, mainly guillemot and gannets. Strangely, only seen one cormorant with a large colony at Scotstoun. I've been using the Beach Track app to record some of these findings for SMASS.
I don't know. Scottish.
We could just guess on that one.
Which we will, probably. Let's go back to birds. Mute swans are amongst the largest birds you'll find in Scotland. And I remember my wife very nearly ended up in serious problems because she was out hacking around the side of a loch and one of these things took off. And it put the horse in the path of a bus because the horse went, I have no idea what that is and I'm not hanging around to find out. I mean, these swans are noisy.
Yes, they are. And when they take flight, it's such a unique sound, isn't it? Recently, when I was in Orkney, I was driving along the road near the Ring of Brodker with Rebecca Marr, who we heard from earlier, and she pointed out two mute swans' nests within a few metres of each other, one on the shores of the brackish Loch of Stennis and the other one a bit further up within the grasses. Two of the same species, but with very different nests.
There it is.
Yep. And that's a swan's nest.
Yeah, made from reed canary grass.
And what can you see within it?
I can see two eggs, unfortunately, with no swan on them. I saw the swan earlier with four cygnets. She could be over this side because they can pass between these two.
Can they get underneath the root?
Yeah.
The nest, beautifully constructed with the grass, with two enormous eggs, so it's slightly concerning that they may have passed their best, those final two eggs.
Yeah, she may have just cut her losses when the first chicks came.
Yeah,
and just abandoned the nest, because as you can see, it's at a very kind of busy place.
Well, that's the thing that's amazing.
Oh, there she is.
Oh, you see it?
Yeah. So I don't know much about swans, but there's a pair of swans there, so do you think that's both parents? I don't know how it works.
Yeah, I was wondering that. Oh, look at the sweet, fluffy cygnets.
Oh, they're almost blue-grey, aren't they? There they are in the shallow water. So she must have had six eggs and she's got her four cygnets there, four chicks. Are there cygnets at that age or are they just chicks?
I don't know. I'm sure someone will tell us. This nest is so close to the road. You wouldn't think it was a very sensible place to build a nest.
It could be that she's not that experienced, maybe, and she's not realised how busy it is.
Yeah.
Because it busies up as the season goes on. So I'm sure when she started building the nest, she didn't know there was going to be buses going past her.
Cruise ship buses.
And look, Helen, if you look over there,
Yeah. There's
another nest with a swan sitting on it. But this time the nest is constructed of seaweed from the shore. So there you go, that's two of my favourite things.
Grasses and seaweed.
Grasses and seaweed, and now swans.
And put to good use. It's like a fortress of seaweed she's got there. It's a little mound, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really quite high, isn't it? I'm really into the work of Gunny Moberg, the photographer. And it really reminds me of this sheep fort that she'd photographed in off Westry that was built like that. It was kind of raised up.
Yeah.
Almost looked like it was for the sheep to protect them when the tides came in, the seaweed eating sheep, so they could run up into this fort and wait between tides.
And we're not quite sure what's going on there, but she's very much spread in the nest. You think she might have cygnets under there?
I think she might, because she just looks quite spread out, as you see, and a little bit fluffy. Her bum does look big in that, I would say. It's quite striking, isn't it? The black seaweed and the white swan.
Yeah. Very striking indeed.
When I was going past that, the swan that's very close to the road, who's on the grass nest,
yeah,
she was actually up one day and turning the
you
eggs
saw
over.
Her do that?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was amazing. I mean, I've never seen that before.
Rebecca Marr there with a heap of unanswered questions. So we thought we'd call upon the expertise of Alan Leach from the RSPB in Orkney. Good morning, Alan.
Morning.
Listen, this is a wild shot, but you don't happen by any chance to know those two nests.
Yeah, I do actually. I monitor birds at the Broadgar RSPB Reserve, so drive past it on my way.
So is the fact they are so close to the road, is that typical of swans?
It's not that unusual. They're fairly tolerant of people. They don't have that many natural predators in the UK, so and especially in Orkney, we don't have foxes. Foxes are one of the main predators for mute swan.
And is it unusual to have nests made of different materials like this, in this case seaweed and grass?
So the two nests you're describing, I mean, they're fairly typical on Orkney. The seaweed one less so, but obviously, you know, grass nests are more normal. But that's the two types of nests that you do generally find in Scotland, either seaweed or nests of grasses like canary reed grass and Phragmites reed.
And were we right to call the chicks cygnets? Or are they chicks? Are they cygnets? When do they become one or the other?
Well, they become cygnets. We call them cygnets when the eggs hatch.
And can you give me an update on how those swans are doing and those cygnets are doing?
Yeah, so I heard you making reference to the fact that there were some unhatched eggs in the nest. That's not that unusual for swans. I mean, swans lay between 4 and 7 eggs on average. They can lay more than that, but that's kind of average clutch size. Those 4 eggs that were left, probably infertile. The other eggs that hatched, the 3 eggs that hatched, I think from what I saw the other day, it looks like there's only 2 cygnets remaining. There's many pairs nest around the shores of Lochar Stennis and Lochar Harry in Orkney. Around 40 pairs, with up to about 100 pairs nesting in Orkney.
Wow! So it's a bit of a special place then, because it's not quite unusual from this part of the world that we come on from seeing swans nesting like that. We saw another swan beside one of the nests. Would that have been the male? And do they have a lifelong monogamous relationship?
Yeah, so pairs do mate for life. The female does all the incubation, but the pair are both involved in the actual nest building. So the male will bring the material to the female, and the female will be standing on the platform, the nest, and she will add the material to the nest. So it's very much a joint thing.
Tell you what I've seen sometimes, Alan, and I don't entirely understand it, because you tend to see swans in pairs. Every so often you'll get a big lump of them. You know, I mean, I think the most I've ever saw was about 70 or 80, you know, in a field somewhere. Why do they do that?
So, you know, swans don't breed until they're about 3 or 4 years old. So you've got a large population of non-breeding birds, young birds from the previous years. So during the breeding season, when there's birds on territory, pairs on territory, they're very defensive of that territory. So the younger birds kind of clear out and they end up, you know, clubbing together in other freshwater bodies to avoid any aggravation.
Is there a name for those collections?
A group of swans is known as a herd.
A herd. A herd of swans. I like it. Alan, thank you very much for that. Much obliged to you.
No problem at all. Have a good day.
Isn't it great that you actually knew the two nests you were talking about?
Yes. Well, they're pretty prominent.
Yeah.
You just drive along the road to Broadgar and you can't miss them.
Yeah.
Which is why it was so surprising, because they were just right there. You just think, this is happening. That's the wonderful thing about Orkney, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's happening all around you.
Yeah.
All these wildlife spectacles, as it were.
No, it's great. Let's go back to Whithorn and Galloway now. I was talking earlier to Julia Muir-Watt, who's Chief Executive of the Whithorn Trust. And I really wanted to find out a bit more about the newly mapped walking and cycling route, which is called the Whithorn Way.
It is roughly 149 miles. It starts at Glasgow Cathedral and it winds its way on some very quiet routes through the central belt. You wouldn't believe that you're in the cities. And it ends on the coast at Irvine, and then it comes down the Ayrshire coastal path and goes inland from south of Girvan through very rural Dumfries and Galloway until it gets here. And then there's an onward section to the Isle of Whithorn, where we're currently building some off-road paths.
How closely does that mimic the original pilgrimage route?
This is an interpretation of the westerly route. Obviously, we've avoided modern roads, but we know, for instance, given the Ninian names that are on the way, the place names, that we are following where pilgrims went. We know quite a lot about the routes because famed people at the time, like the kings and queens, kept treasurer's accounts. So we know their stopping places, and their stopping places are often still great abbeys, which are preserved at least in part, like Crossraigle, like Glenluce. We know those were overnight stopovers. The abbeys had to provide free accommodation. And we know from the treasurer's accounts where the kings and queens gave alms and where they spent money. So we have a fair idea this is the westerly route.
I've been down to St Ninian's Cave down on the coast, not terribly far away. Do people still... I'm trying to think. Do people still do authentic pilgrimage? I mean, yes, they can do the route, which is the site of a former pilgrimage route, but are they still on pilgrimage, some of them?
Some of them, very definitely. There was a revival of pilgrimage by the Catholic Church in the 1880s under the Marquess of Bute, who was a great patron of the Catholic Church and of heritage in this area. And then by the 1930s, that became a sort of annual pilgrimage, and that still goes on. So every August, last Sunday in August, we expect the Galloway Diocese. Pre-COVID, that was busloads of people, and they make their way on foot down to the cave and hold a mass there. So you can see when you go to the cave, there are votive offerings, which is really in an ancient tradition. The earliest graffiti on the cave is from the 8th century, and it goes up to 2022. So, well, it's very live.
The last time I was down there, along the shingle beach which leads you up to the cave, people had been getting bits of driftwood and tying them together with bits of old net and things like that into crosses.
Yes.
And it was... curiously effective. I mean, I can't. It kind of touched you.
Yes, I think people have a sense of atmosphere when they go there. There is such an ancient tradition of spirituality, whether they're religious or not. And many people perhaps put memorials, as they do on roadside memorials, to somebody who's passed on, and they want to think of them there. So it's still a very special place, whether you're Orthodox or not.
And the priory is just across there. I've been in there.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the idea of doing, you know, a medieval pilgrimage, of basically relying on charity all the way down, processing with other pilgrims, arriving in there, and then basically starting off and working your way in almost in a spiral pattern to the Holy of Holies in the centre.
Yes.
Really appeals to me.
Yes. I mean, we know that there was a sort of circuit for people, and we know there were feast days. There's one just coming up at the start of June. And there's a medieval, a 14th century description of people taking the shrine out of town, leaving it there for a couple of days, and then when it comes back in a sort of triumphal procession, they all tried to touch it. So we know that that sort of tradition of popular piety was very live at Whithorn, and actually it was one of the most popularly revered pilgrimage destinations in Scotland at one point, more than more famed saints like St Andrew or St Columba.
Mm-hmm. I think it's great the way that you've tied together the very real depth of history in this place with traditional skills, training young people, etc., trying to sort of get a handle on unemployment in the area and things. It's very clever the way you've stitched it all together.
We recognise that museums are now required almost to do different things than they used to do. They used to be a place that you went and reverently looked at objects, and that's still a very valid function, and we told the stories in very traditional ways on interpretation boards. But now I think many museums like us are acting outside their walls. There is a question of social responsibility, which I think is very strong at Whithorn because it's a monastic site. And we think there are very exciting things that we can do well beyond our exhibition to engage people with the heritage. So they may understand more about pilgrimage if they actually walk it. They may understand more about medieval cathedrals if they actually start making the planks to make one. So it is about broadening audiences. It's the future, and we think it's made our museum and our organisation as a whole much more vibrant by doing that.
Julia Muir-Watt of the Whithorn Trust. I actually quite fancy doing that.
Oh, just do it. Yeah, just go and do it, you know. Just don't hold back.
Don't hold back. Just crack on. Get on with it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a great believer in that.
Yeah, just get out. Get out there and
just
do
it. Just do it.
Yeah.
We've had some more correspondence from overseas.
Oh, this is getting in my wick.
Nick McCormack says, "Hello, Mark and Helen. Listening to you from the water's edge in Polenta, Mallorca. I'm here for a week, but love tuning into Out of Doors. Brilliant show.
Hope it rains.
8:30 a.m. and already 29 degrees. Oh. Time to find some shade.
Yes, and a beer.
And Scott and Nadia from Bothwell, currently in Veal. Morning Out of Doors team, we're missing getting wrong the mystery bird, the highlight of our Saturday. Yes, sorry about that.
Yes,
normal
yes.
service will be resumed in a couple of weeks.
He's got it copyrighted, you see. Nobody's allowed to touch it.
No. Visiting the Outlaws for the first time since 2019, basking in a sunny and hot Switzerland, listening to frogs and quite a few mystery birds. Keep up the good work. And you know, Ian Bruce was talking about the SMASS, and
yes.
we didn't know what that was. Well, thank you, David in Edinburgh, who's taken the time to look it up. It's the Scottish Marine Animal Stranding Scheme.
Right, okay. Okay, well, thank you so much for that. That's very kind. As we mentioned, the Royal Highland Show's back next week after a gap of, but we reckon it's about 3 years. 2019 was the last time that it actually ran. To get you in the spirit for the show this year, this is something that we stumbled on the last time it ran. You and I were wondering about it, and we stumbled upon this rather bizarre contraption at the National Sheep Association tent.
Jim Smith, farmer and comedian, is on top of a bicycle which has no front wheel, and it's connected to this Heath Robinson device, which has got a drive belt, which is actually powering the sheep shearing gear.
That looks like hard work. We've got the commentator here, Cyril. Tell us, how exciting is this?
This is absolutely fantastic. I don't think we've ever seen anything like this at the Highland Show before, have we?
And you've got a lineup of various people powering the bike.
We have, yes, we've got a lineup. Well, that's farmer Jim Smith there, just been powering the bike. We've had Scott Donaldson. I think we've got George Lyon coming along in a moment. So it's great to see these people coming along and flexing their muscles to power that bike.
That is more exercise than Jim Smith's done in many a year. Come on, speak to me. Sing me a song.
You don't mind wheezing for a little while for us?
Bicycle by Queen. This is cruelty.
It is. I mean, Scott Donaldson's smiling, but he's got the jelly legs, and I think Jim's quite. I think Jim's unable to speak at the moment.
Has this got practical applications, or is it just fun?
Well, it has got a practical application. If there's a power cut and you've still got some sheep left to clip, you can do it with a bike. So it could have. Of course, it's just fun at the moment, but it has a practical application too.
I think the BBC ought to be doing the cycling bit.
You reckon?
Do you want another hand clip one to take it out more, or another cyclist?
How you doing, Mr. Fowle?
You want Mark to do one? Just to...
I'll easy pedal if you want.
Mark, you want a pedal?
I'll pedal.
Okay, here we go.
I'll pedal. Right, no problem.
Mark will do it.
There you go.
Okay. Mark's getting up there. So you're going to manage on the bike?
With some difficulty.
So how long is this going to take you?
I'll just be doing the belly just now, and then Emily's going to finish the sheep off.
So my colleague Mark Stephen is doing the cycling. How hard work is it?
As long as your shears are sharp enough, it's not hard at all. The biggest thing is getting your shears sharp enough to keep cutting. If they're shears are sharp, you should have no problem shearing the sheep at all.
Great. Emily's here. I'll just ask you, how does it compare to using an electric setup?
I mean, the blades definitely have their place on the hill, but electric shears are just far more efficient, and with today's technology, you can shear a sheep in seconds.
Tell me about your shoes.
These are moccasins made from leather, and they help us grip the sheep, grip the board, and get more balance while we're shearing the sheep.
So how hard are you going to have to pedal?
Oh, he's going to have to go a few k's, and, you know, he's going to have to power on.
Well, we shall see. You ready to go, eh? Right. The sheep's prepared, ready to go.
You reckon?
Yeah, apparently it's equivalent to about 40 miles.
Is it? It's a flipping lie, honestly.
Right.
Say when.
Okay, just... They're getting limbering up now. Okay, we've got the yow on its back. It's been dragged into the centre.
Uh-huh.
Popped between her legs. Poised, ready to go.
Ready?
And he's off.
The saddle could be higher. This is an awkward position.
How are you feeling?
Don't expect me to speak at the same time.
pressure. Well, I mean, there's a real worry. If you don't pedal properly, they're going to injure that sheep.
Oh, that's good to know. Has she even started yet?
Yeah, bumping on just 60% done.
Just 60?
Yeah. Probably a bit more fast. Need to be a bit faster, I think.
Thank you.
Right, we just... Beautiful curving arc with her shears. It is a thing of beauty to watch.
I'm really running out of breath here.
Yeah. It's quite difficult because there's a whole sea of people watching this. And if you were to stop now, you'd be humiliated.
I might have to stop.
Well, I'll keep going, you can do it. Final. The final run now. Keep going, keep going. You're slowing down, I can hear it. More, a bit more.
What? Give me a couple of more sheep.
Okay.
Oh, thank God.
Give him a big round of applause.
That was murder. That was genuinely murder.
What's amusing me is the fact that Ewan didn't put himself forward for that. He just sort of disappeared into the background there.
Yes, I'll stand back here and do the commentary. Yeah, it'll be fine. And he's shouting things like, bring more sheep. No, don't bring more sheep.
And that actually makes me excited about the Highland Show, because all these funny things happen there. Yeah. That you find yourself in these strange situations.
Well, you know what it's like, you know, I remember going there donkeys years ago, and without a doors, and we found a guy who had old sit-up-and-beg bicycles for sale. Brand new, old-fashioned sit-up-and-beg bicycles. And in much the same way that they still make, I think it's Morris Oxfords in India, to the original pattern. Somebody had found this old bicycle pattern in India and was making them. You know, and they had rod brakes and everything else. And I wrote this thing about the show and all, but we've got to get one of these. Got to get one. What a machine it was.
Oh, it's amazing what amuses you, isn't it? Right, Craig Wilson from Carl Journal's been in touch. I'm listening whilst relaxing in a warm bath.
Too much information.
Prior to heading down to Root and Burn in Largs for a round of golf with my brothers Scott and Russell. Fantastic scenic views over the Firth of Clyde, battling it out for the Wilson Whistlers Trophy. First round of golf for me in 8 years, so it should be interesting. There will be no mystery birdies for me.
No. I'll see what he did there. We noticed the other day that the 21st of this month, aside from being the day before the summer solstice, is also National Nude Hiking Day.
Oh.
Now, I mentioned this.
Will you be
this,
participating?
Well, probably in the dead of night, to be honest. We, you and I were trying to work how we could do it without actually getting arrested. And dead of night would seem to be it. It was slightly complicated by the fact, you know, he's not good on detail. I mentioned this to him, and he thought I said National Nude Hitchhiking Day.
For goodness sake.
Well, that's definitely going to get us arrested. I've got a lovely picture here from Kevin Brown about his Situtery here in Milgai, a self-design and build project that he has just completed, and it's gorgeous. Well done, that man. Very nice. If the object of the exercise has been to irritate me, it's worked. That's it from this week. Don't forget our New Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon. In our midweek podcast, we've got Galloway farmer and author Patrick Laurie, who's I'd like to speak to. We'll be at the Royal Highland Show next week. From all of the team here in Aberdeen, thanks for listening.